This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So there's this image that might come to mind when you think of a gamer. Geeky teenage boy with his eyes glued to a screen and his thumbs stuck to a controller. And if that's what you think, then you might be surprised to hear that women account for more than half of the gaming population and more than a third is over 36 years old. Video games have expanded into an art form complete with complex narratives, cultural critiques, and symphonic soundtracks. They don't sound like this anymore. So today we're going to spend the whole hour on video games. And first we're going to take a look at the social side of gaming. For that, we're joined by Nick Taylor. He's a professor of digital media at North Carolina State University. Welcome, Nick. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you recently published a study called Public Displays of Play, Studying Online Games and Physical Spaces. Tell us about it.
So this work really drew off of the work I did for my postdoctoral research at York University in Toronto, where me and the team I was involved with over the course of about 3 years visited over 20 sites where people were playing video games in public. So everything from internet cafes in Toronto and Vancouver to larger scale video gaming conventions in those same cities. And eventually we packed our bags and said, let's go where the real stuff is. And we went to the UK, where you have, you know, these in the middle of nowhere, these 2,000 plus person video gaming mega parties where people bring their own computers, strap them together into a local area network or LAN, and basically spend 4 days over the course of a banking holiday, getting drunk and playing video games, among other things.
Well, that means you have to have a banking holiday in order to enjoy that many people.
I know, we're so far behind.
Wait, so it ain't exactly NASCAR, but the idea of people coming together in a same space to play video games is perhaps surprising to some people. We think of being, you know, sort of in your basement, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, for a lot of these, the people that we talk to, that's their usual video game context, but that never does mean antisocial necessarily. I mean, you know, we observe people, even when they look like they're playing on their own, they would be playing in a virtual world with other people. They would be chatting to the people on either side of them at the LAN party or at the internet cafe. They would be, on Instant Messenger or Skype with their friends. And, you know, there'd be layers and layers of sociality that they're involved in, even when they're playing, you know, a single-player game.
Okay, but the doomsayers are going to say that's the problem, that all this fragmented attention and a lot of it attention to people who aren't in the room is sort of what's wrecking everything for us in terms of social behavior.
Right, and, I would say, you know, this is... Why do we need to see this as detractive? Why can't we see it as additive, right? I mean, these people were more than capable of holding a one-to-one classic style of conversation when called upon to. It's just that, you know, why would they do that when they can do that and so much more? I mean, so it's not like they've lost the ability to communicate in conventional classic contexts. It's that they've gained the ability to communicate in so many other contexts, often simultaneously, often with... no loss of quote-unquote quality. You know, these are people that are adept at communicative multitasking.
And that interpersonal behavior and relationship is evolving. Talk about some of the behaviors that happen in these contexts where people are playing games and also in the same room.
Well, so you have these really kind of rich, playful spaces where there would be... they'd be taunting and trash-talking with their neighbors even as they're engaged in an epic collaborative battle against, these various big dragons and bosses in games like World of Warcraft. And then they would drop that game, and then they'd all start... I mean, games at events like this tend to go viral, so people might all be playing World of Warcraft one day, and then the very next day, or at 3 o'clock that morning, you might see a game, for instance, Pirates versus Ninjas versus Cowboys, really take off, and all of a sudden, 2,000 people in the same space are playing the same game, and it's these forms of kind of collective action that kind of tend to sweep across these events like wildfire, because people aren't just talking online; they're also communicating face to face. They're you know, they're texting each other. They're, you know, they're playing whatever is hot and whatever their neighbor is playing.
Is there a way to compare the kinds of behavior, facial expressions, gestures, verbal communication to kind of what happens at the pub? And is there any value in asking ourselves, is it different? And that, because it seems to me it gets at the quality question, if you can try to make the comparison.
I mean, you know,
not like just getting drunk and falling down in your suds is really social behavior.
That's fun too. No, I mean, you make a good point, but I think the really interesting thing about games is that they don't just remediate one form of communication and socializing. They remediate all sorts of different forms. So depending on the context you go to or the event that you're watching, it could resemble a sporting event more than a pub, right? Or it could resemble, a friendly game, you know, a friendly match of basketball, or it could resemble a professional NBA game, you know. So I think, you know, the really interesting thing with studying games in physical settings is that you see all sorts of comparisons, not just to pubs or not just to, you know, playing board games together, but to all sorts of social activities, because games are such a multivariate and multifaceted medium that they're capable of taking on all sorts of different social formations.
What kind of communication do you see? I understand there's some fairly interesting shorthand that takes place in communicating, right?
So that kind of comes out of my work and a lot of other of my colleagues' work studying the professionalization of video game play in the form of what's called electronic sports or esports. And where you have typically young men getting together and kind of participating in an industry that very much tries to frame competitive team-based gaming as the next big spectator sport. And so in these kinds of contexts, often you don't see what your teammates see. And so you get these rapid shorthand ways of communicating. You know, I'd compare it to, submarines trying to communicate and also to a point guard trying to communicate to his teammates or her teammates on a basketball floor, this kind of hybrid forms of communication that are once technological as well as strategic. And so you get things like, you know, if you and I were on the same team in Halo 3, which was a game in the community I was studying at the time, I would say, Frank, two top gold. And you, being an expert Halo 3 player, would know, there's two enemies that Nick is seeing at the top of the gold elevator in the particular map we're going to, so I better run over there and see if I can help him out.
So that's fascinating in and of itself, that our language itself and forms of communication are going to evolve and adapt to these new contexts. Mm-hmm. What about the idea, you said something earlier, that the gaming companies are trying to frame this as the next new spectator sport. Why? I mean, were they not content to have thousands and millions of people in their basements playing this? Well, what's the advantage to them? Why do they see?
I mean, because there's lots of times when you're not playing, and so you may as well be watching other people play. You know, so my own role has increasingly shifted from someone who watches people play to the sexy formulation of someone who watches people watch other people play, as interesting as that sounds. But it really is, we're seeing a moment now in which spectatorship is really becoming something else you can do with games. You're seeing people in South Korea, for instance, who are as popular, if not more popular, than any other mainstream media personality. These are gamers. These are young men that are held up as superstars because of their gaming prowess in games like League of Legends and StarCraft II. And we're seeing that kind of slowly poured over to North America, where people in the studies that I've talked to spend as much time watching other people play games, either in live context or on a context like Twitch.tv, which is the fourth biggest internet site in terms of internet traffic. They watch as much as they play, if not more.
Well, and that does suggest that there's something essentially social about us, and that video games are not about to wring this out of us.
Absolutely not. No. In fact, I mean, the gamers that I talked to and that we watched are never not social, let's put it that way. They even when they're playing single-player games, they are participating in something that they can then talk to their friends afterwards about that. Or, you know, they're going on message boards and getting hints and tips about how to beat the game, or they're watching other people play on another internet browser.
Here is a complaint, though, that I've heard from a number of people in a number of quarters, that, you know, misogyny is somehow built into this, despite the fact that over half of the players are now women, that this has not been wrung out of the games.
Absolutely not. In fact, there are some suggestions which show that it's even as things are progressing. You always want to try to complicate notions of progress. Even as things are progressing, there are core aspects of the gaming community and the gaming industry which are becoming, if not more misogynistic, at least as misogynistic as they were in years past, and homophobic and racist. And so, for instance, as much as I kind of describe in glowing terms the kinds of activities and the socializing and communicating that went on at these tournaments and public gaming events that I went to, it was fairly predictable in terms of who was participating. And that's not just maintained by the kinds of games they're playing, because we don't want to ever just reduce the cause of, misogyny in gaming to, characters or plot lines. We want to look at, the kinds of, the social context and right. the social formations that pop up around this, which are often very kind of a typical male locker room kind of scenario, you have people yelling rape or, yelling things I can't say on radio, just as a mundane matter of communication.
But all of this suggests that video games, far from replacing the social order, in fact, very much reflect and embrace a social order that is misogynistic, that is homophobic. These are the foundations of our social order, and not surprising, as well as socialization.
Yeah.
Not surprising, we find them in video games.
Absolutely, and so I'd like to kind of problematize the statistics that you led off with, which is close to 50% of the game playing public is female. What kinds of games are they playing? There's such a wide and varied medium that we can't just say, this game is the same as that game. Flappy Birds is the same as League of Legends.
Fascinating stuff, Nick. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Nick Taylor is a professor of digital media at North Carolina State University. On the state of things, coming up next, the expansion of video games, art, culture, and music. You're going to hear more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Do you remember the game Pong? Oh, yeah, I could listen to that forever. So simulated table tennis, in case you aren't old enough to remember this, and although it was huge for its time, it's going to be hard to argue that it had much in the way of narrative value. Today, storytelling is an important element in games, and it helps the industry reach wider audiences than ever before. I'm joined now by Janelle Bonanno, who is the editor-in-chief of the online gaming magazine Gamefront.com. It's a Defy Media property. Janelle, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about the video industry, of course, has changed quite a bit, particularly when it comes to storytelling in games, right?
Yeah. I mean, back, when you look back in the 80s and sort of the beginning of video games, a lot of it was based on, skill-based games, not so much about story and narrative and more about flow. And a lot of it, I think, was technological sort of limitations on games, but it was also mimicking sports at the time. Pong mimicked table tennis and such like that. And as games have grown as an interactive medium, we've seen more and more story elements and narrative enter the field. On one hand, the technology has allowed us to kind of bring in that sort of immersive experience in the digital medium. But separately, as the gaming demographic has grown, we've seen that's what people have wanted in the industry.
Well, tell us more about it. That's fascinating, that storytelling would be something we would want essentially restored or built into what was a kind of a shoot 'em up a business, right? Things would fall or move and you would try to hit them. And storytelling, of course, is an essential part of what it means to be human. And we wanted that back in, to be put into story, to video games.
Yeah. And you look at any sort of traditional entertainment medium, whether it be movies, television, music, they all sort of tell a story that people can relate to and get immersed in and sort of have their emotions triggered. And when it comes to video games, the field of people who played them at the time when they were purely skill-based, games were hard. If anyone, you know, who is a current gamer tries and goes back to play some of those traditional games, those old-school platformers required a ton of skill, and not many people were able to get into them. And it wasn't until we realized that there was more to fun and play than just, can I get the highest score?
Right.
Do I have the better skill? That we really started to reach out to a wider demographic and really immerse them in traditional, the way traditional entertainment has always done.
So you heard Nick Taylor. We were just talking toward the end of that conversation about women in as gamers and people who play games. So what kind of games are you interested in? Because I understand you had an interesting experience playing Wolfenstein at one point, right?
Yes. So I am into a wide variety of games. I love, you know, the RPGs, which are role-playing style games, very centered on narrative and storyline. I also really love, you know, stereotypical first-person shooters, but more the story-driven ones, less so just the plain, regular, you know, military aspect ones. Mm-hmm. And Wolfenstein is a new game that just came out that really brings in the story narrative into that sort of realm of the shooter and brings the humanity into it versus just beat 'em up, shoot 'em up.
And what was your experience in that game?
And spoilers, I don't want to spoil the game for anyone, but you know, if you want to play Wolfenstein, this is your time to cover your ears. but there is a part early in the game where, so Wolfenstein is based in an alternate universe where the Nazis actually won World War II, and you're playing 20 years into the future, and your character is part of an underground resistance movement trying to rectify and bring about democracy back into the world. And there's a point where you and your resistance team gets captured, and you actually have to make a choice between, you know, who is going to be left alive, the remainder of the team that's going to be killed, and the teammate that you pick to be alive will not just be spared, but be used for torture. So the choices are strong moral strings that they pull on, that they're expecting you to really play with. And when I first played it, I actually couldn't make a choice. I sat in front of my computer for a good 15, 20 minutes just being like, nope, I can't do it.
It turns out the developers of Wolfenstein, you were not alone, right?
Yeah. You know, back before the game was released, when there was just hands-on, you know, you were able to sort of stay in that stasis of indecision for as long as possible, and the game would just wait for you to finally make a choice. Then when the game was released, they actually changed that. So if you waited too long, there was a timer that made everyone die because you didn't make the decision. Game over, and it resets the scenario. And now you're right back at the beginning of the scenario where you have to make that choice.
So as in all moral choices, no choice is a choice.
Yes, exactly.
And they do that. Well, and the other part of the reality is you talked about and trying to restore democracy as though that's science fiction. Hey, that's the project today.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of kind of moral impetus behind even the premise that we're trying to restore democracy.
Yeah, and
which
a lot
I would
of
argue
cultural teaching
is today's project.
A lot of cultural teaching that could come out of that.
A game showing called Papers, Please, for instance.
Yeah. Yes. So Papers, Please is a video game, a small little indie game where you actually play a border control agent in a Eastern European country that has a socialist type government. And you're basically there to let people into the country and check their passports. And the more people you let into the country, the more money you make, because every day you have to feed your family, pay for heating, pay for rent. But at the same time, there's restrictions, right? There could be a terrorist attack that happens that will cause restrictions that only, you know, certain parameters are allowed in. And you have to go as fast as possible to try to make the money. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to deny everyone because you need to make the money. And so things come up in this game where you'll have an underground resistance movement who try to bribe you into letting them in and take the passports, which could lead anywhere to 20 different alternate endings, depending on how you act and respond as sort of the gateway to the border of this country.
And of course, you can legitimately find virtue in your decision to take the bribe because for all the other reasons that you said, letting this person in could have.
are you looking to what is more important, supporting your family, supporting your country, doing a good job, or...
So all of this exercise in moral decision making is one of the reasons why, and one of the areas in which games have kind of proliferated. And so I want to expand this conversation now and bring in Catherine Hales. She's a literature professor at Duke University and helped create a game called Speculation. Catherine, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Tell us about Speculation.
Speculation is loosely based on the 2008 financial crisis. And it's set at some time in the near future when the euro has collapsed in the eurozone. With it, a coalition of investment banks has bailed the world out, but at the expense of taking control of the world economy.
That could never happen.
Well, that's what we thought when we were making the game, but we were terrified the euro would collapse. And
we may not have to wait that long. So tell us about, I mean, the impetus behind this, and of course you're going to get people to play to kind of, this is to understand what's behind all this. What is a monetary system?
And exactly. Yes. And so in our game, a resistance movement has arisen, the leader of which is called Nex. And Nex has been caught and is being interrogated by a software program run by Metacorp. That provides the narrative of the game, Nex's interrogation and his fencing with this software program. And then the gameplay creates opportunities for players to perform various tasks, get passwords from those tasks when they're completed, which put back into the game, open another section of the narrative.
And this is a game that intrudes on your real life, right? Because you end up getting text messages on your actual phone once you've if you've hacked a system.
Yes, it's an alternate reality game. And so it plays across multiple platforms, digitally, various software programs, and also in the real world.
What prompted you, a literature professor, to start developing a game like this?
I became co-director of a humanities lab at Duke called Greater Than Games, and our purview was to create socially constructed games. And at the same time, I was one of millions of people who were deeply affected by the 2008 financial crisis. I lost a third of my life savings in a matter of a few weeks. So I personally was very interested in finding out how this could happen and creating a vehicle that would explore that, but also disseminate some of that knowledge.
So who's playing the game?
Well, the first time through the game, we had about 3,000 players from 12 different countries who participated, and there was an attrition as the game went on. We estimate it takes about 100 hours to get through the entire game, but we had a dedicated core of players who lasted to the very end. I should also mention my two co-directors here, Patrick Jagoda at the University of Chicago and Patrick Lemieux, a grad student at Duke.
So you say there's some attrition. Is it the sort of game that you think could go viral? Would it be a commercial success, or do you think that it would only survive in the academy?
Well, it's very, how shall I put it, intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative sections, for example, are heavily spiced with literary references. Players don't need to get those to enjoy the narrative. The narrative itself is extremely complex. Has psychological undertones, it would probably rival a complex literary narrative. And so in that sense, we're not expecting this is going to be a viral hit, but we did intend that it would be useful in game courses.
Yeah, Janelle, when you hear an outline of a game like that, mm-hmm. clearly one that also has these questions of choice and understanding, intellectual capability, you got to figure out how this trick works in order to know who gets fooled and who doesn't. What's the difference between a game that is a huge commercial success, which can be as deep as the moral choices of Papers, Please,
mm-hmm.
And a game like this that may not make it and wasn't designed for commercial success?
So what would make a commercial success,
you're
asking?
Yeah.
A lot of times it's about pulling together all of the elements in a proper way. Games have a lot of fundamental aspects that they try to hit. There's theories called flow, which is, you know, giving the player the ability to find a way where they feel like they've mastered the skill and it now becomes intuitive play. So they're no longer outside of the game. They're in and immersed in the game. You know, now bringing flow into fun and figuring out how you can take the narrative, take the play and make it a fun experience and also challenge. Gamers and people love to feel like they are getting better at something, they're succeeding at something, and they're winning. Pulling all those elements together generally leads to a very solid game. When a game leaves off something like poor narrative or poor elements of flow and game design, that's when you start seeing bits and pieces fall apart, and it ruins the immersive experience for the player.
Now, of course, Catherine, you're not aiming for this kind of a success or this kind of a program or a game, but you are hoping that people will get a deeper understanding of certainly the financial networks and also some of the literary sources that you quote. Any indication that that's happening? How can you tell?
Well, that's a good question. I wish we had had Janelle on our team when we were designing this game, because we made some mistakes on the first time through. And in fact, we ran a test run after that initial gameplay with a group of Duke undergraduates who are all expert game players. And based on their feedback, we then began a massive redesign of the game precisely to improve the aspects that Janelle was just speaking about. As a result of that redesign, we got a lot of information from two courses where it was taught in the course, one at the University of Chicago and one at Vassar College. And many of those players, in fact, did find it immersive.
So that's it. I mean, there's nothing inherently about the topic. You can talk about a financial restructuring or just be trying to steal a car. In both cases, if all of these basic elements are right, you can engage people.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a recent game that came out called Goat Simulator, where you literally play a goat.
You mean you pretend you are one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, you are playing a goat in this open world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, on the off top, like just thinking about it that way, well, how fun could that be? Just being a goat on a farm. And you know what? This game ended up being really fun and immersive to play. So topic a lot of times doesn't necessarily matter if you can hit all the other points and really get the player immersed in what you're trying to portray.
And Catherine, this real world immersive experience that you create, I mean, tell us more about that and the ways in which the game starts crossing platforms and intruding essentially on your real life.
Well, one of the interesting aspects of our game was the involvement of players in the design of the game. So on the redesign, we discovered that players had, in the forum that we set up, become interested in a figure that was very marginal in the first design of the game. But once we realized the players were speculating about this character's background, we then created a whole bunch of more materials which fleshed out his backstory, complicated it, and so forth. So you could say that we were involved in a kind of recursive loop with the players. We were using their own comments to design the next step of the game.
And that's where having good literary skill and knowledge can help you build the narrative based on the information that you get. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You also, I mean, you're using real money. You had money from Zimbabwe that was actual currency that you found itself in circulation, right?
Yes. I bought some $50 trillion Zimbabwe banknotes on eBay, stamped them with the Metacorp stamp and the URL for our landing page, and passed them out on campus. And one of those found its way into a Starbucks tip jar. So clearly they were, in a sense, circulating.
And the idea that this stuff is going to be real currency or an actual text that shows up on your phone because of, you know, you hacked into the computer system and you got the passwords and that sort of thing, I guess that's a way of keeping the game sort of on your conscience or on your consciousness, even if you're not at the console that you're playing on.
There's a term from one of William Gibson's novel called apophenia, and it means seeing patterns in random data. So it ties into conspiracy theories and so forth. And one of our goals in the game was to create an apophenia in which people who encountered these various rabbit holes couldn't be sure if this was a game or if this was some kind of real-world conspiracy.
Janelle, are we seeing more and more of that in the game?
Yeah, that happens all the time in games. You know, game design is a real science. There was a game, there is a game called Civilization that has seen 5 iterations thus far. And I had the pleasure of being able to see Sid Meier talk about it. And it's a war strategy game, all based on math and statistics. And the original iterations were all about real statistics and how real statistics work. So if you were given a 70% chance to win the battle, players assumed that the more times they would have the battle, they should eventually win. And if they weren't winning, the game was playing against them. There was a conspiracy, the game was cheating, all these things, not realizing, well, you know, that's the way statistics works. Every time you have a 70% chance and that 30% can come up. And they had to slowly redesign the game in iterations to use fake statistics, or more accurately, statistics the way people believe statistics actually work. So the game actually changes every time you lose a battle without telling the player. The game changes the algorithm and makes it easier and easier for you to win. So the player's expected outcome works, and they lose that sort of sense of conspiracy and that the game's against them.
And by changing the statistics to fit the game, it's based more on politics than science.
Yes.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yes.
I want to thank you all for being on the show. Janelle Bonanno is the editor-in-chief of GameFront.com. Janelle, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Hales is a literature professor at Duke University and co-creator of the game Speculation. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, the evolution of music in games. It's come a long way since Bloop Bleep. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Music in video games used to be simple. Bleep, bloop. Remember Space Invaders? Well, soundtracks these days are a bit more complex, and video game composer Tommy Tallarico wants everybody to know about it. He's touring a concert series called Video Games Live. It presents live symphony and choral performances of video game music. It's in Raleigh tonight, North Carolina Symphony, 7:30 at May Mandy Concert Hall. Composer Tommy Tallarico is with us in the studio, along with Jillian Aversa. She's here. She's a video game vocalist. She is also performing tonight at Video Games Live. Tommy, Jillian, welcome.
Thanks for having us. Yeah,
great to be here.
Tell us about this, about the concert series itself, Tommy.
Yeah, Video Games Live, we've been touring it over 12 years, and it's all the greatest video game music of all time played by a full symphony and choir. But what makes it really special and unique is that everything's completely synchronized to massive video screens, stage show production, rock and roll lighting, special effects, interactive elements with the crowd. So I kind of like to describe it as having all of the power and emotion of a symphony orchestra, but combined with the energy and excitement of a rock concert, mixed together with all the cutting-edge visuals and technology and interactivity and fun that video games provide. So I really wanted to create a show that appealed to everyone. Even if you don't play video games, you can come. You come to the show and you have a greater understanding and appreciation of what it's all about.
Well, did you play video games?
Oh, heck yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm 46 years old, so I was part of the first generation to grow up who was weaned on Space Invaders and Pong. And by the way, I got to say that Space Invaders clip you play was not from the arcade. That was the Atari version, the home version. So just to geek out a little bit on you, I was like, you know, I was expecting to hear the arcade version, but you pulled out the Atari version.
You got the ear. Well, that brings me to this question, which is what inspired you? I mean, clearly you heard some kind of artistic possibilities in this music that maybe a few of us missed along the way?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was 10 years old in the late 70s, I would take my dad's, you know, giant cassette recorder with the D batteries, and I would go down to the arcade and I would record all my favorite video game music. Again, the bleeps and bloops. And I'd take that home and I'd record my home systems as well. And I would put on performances for my neighborhood friends. I'd play the cassette back and I'd jump up in front of my television with my guitar and I'd have my video games on the TV and pretend to put on a show. So I guess it's all manifested itself. No, but my two greatest loves growing up were always video games and music. And, you know, my parents and grandparents always told me, do something that you love in your career and it'll never seem like a job or work, you know. And I was lucky enough to put two of them together because, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, there was no such thing as a video game composer. But 25 years ago, I started in the video game industry and I've worked on over 300 games doing the music for them.
And Jillian, you're doing the vocals. What drew you to this industry and doing vocals for video games?
Well, similarly, you know, I grew up on games, although I'm a little younger than Tommy. And I started remixing songs from video games as a hobby when I was in my college days. And I joined a website community called Overclocked Remix. It's ocremix.org. And it's a community based on arranging music from video games. I met my husband through there. It's actually how I was first introduced to Tommy, because we went to one of the very first Video Games Live shows. And so, I started doing that as a hobby. And then as soon as I graduated from Peabody Conservatory, I went straight to recording for game soundtracks because I wanted to take it to the professional level. So.
And you know, Frank, the interesting thing about the website that she's talking about, she's referring to, is that it's thousands of people all over the world remixing video game music and uploading it to the site. There's tens of thousands of songs on there, and it's all free. You can go on there and check it out. But doesn't that say a lot about the generation of people? They're not remixing movie music. Right. They're not remixing Beethoven. They're not, you know, they're remixing video game music. And there's a huge community where there's video game cover bands now all over the world. In fact, every year in, was it Virginia? Where's Magfest?
Yeah, it's usually in either Northern Virginia or Southern Maryland.
Where they have kind of the Lollapalooza or, if you will, Woodstock of every year. And it's been going on 10 years of video game cover bands.
Well, what's the difference between composing for a video game and, say, a film or what Beethoven was going for?
That's a great question. And by the way, I've always said that if Beethoven were alive today, he'd be a video game composer.
Well, that's where the money is, and he knew where that was,
right?
That's for sure.
And he wouldn't be composing for film because he wouldn't want people talking over his music all the time. So in film, they got dialogue. Right. Video games, we get the action scene every time, right? Which is one of the differences. But you know, one of the huge differences is that film scores are considered post-production. So once everything's done and the linear piece of media is done, then, okay, everybody hurry up. We have 5 weeks to now write all this music and finish it. Whereas a video game takes a couple of years to make, and we're involved all along the way. So we're able to hone our craft a lot more, spend more time on the things. But the biggest difference is the interactivity. So again, even the great John Williams at some point had to sit down with George Lucas, and George Lucas said, okay, at a minute and 30 seconds, the music must do this because Darth Vader walked through the door. And then at 2 minutes, it has to do this because the Death Star blows up, right? So he's trapped within that linear media, and he creates the music around that. Whereas in the video game industry, a designer will come to me and say, hey, here's a scenario. We got 100 guys on horseback with swords all coming to kick your butt. Write me a 3-minute piece of music. Now I can go off into my own little world. But I can also have that same arrangement and then do different orchestrations of it based on here's 100 guys attacking, here's 20 guys. Now, if there's only 10 or 5 or 1, and we record the song in many different ways. Same song, same click track, same tempo, but maybe less instruments or more instruments, or maybe it's a female choir versus a male choir, or a child soprano, or a, you know, timpanis versus taiko drums. And we have all these different layers that we can go into. And that's the biggest difference, right? Is that when you watch a film, you're watching somebody else's story. But the reason so many people are so emotionally attached to video game music is because when you play a video game, you become that character, and the music becomes the soundtrack of your life.
Well, and we played Space Invaders, and that was designed to do just that, right? I mean, it was actually following your heartbeat.
Absolutely. The guy who created Space Invaders, I had a great sit-down with him one time, and he was saying that dun, 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 dun. He started that tempo at the human heartbeat. And MIT did a bunch of research on this, and what happened is as it got quicker and quicker, it physically changed the human heartbeat to get quicker and quicker and quicker. So the audio, the music, literally has physical effects on people's bodies.
And, of course, that's the same design in films. It does have an emotional impact, but as you say, it's more interactive. And because you have more flexibility, it allows you then to create a symphonic piece that stands alone or an orchestral piece that stands alone without the graphics. So let's take a little bit from the soundtrack of Video Games Live. That was the Dragonborn theme from the game Skyrim from Video Games Live, Album 3. Tell us about that piece, Tommy.
Yeah, that's written by Jeremy Soule, a really popular, great video game composer. And the game Skyrim, and this is the great thing about Video Games Live, is not only are you hearing the music, but if you've never played the game or you've never played video games, you'll understand, you'll see the visuals that match the game. And it's, you know, it's Vikings and so that, you know, really comes across in the music, this big epic masterpiece. And it's huge. I mean, it's choir, it's orchestra, it's everything.
Well, Jill, you had an opportunity to sing for the game Halo, right?
Yes.
So tell us about that. What does it mean then to do the vocals for something, again, being game show video game fan, right? And then suddenly having to do the vocals. What was that like for you?
It's really surreal. Growing up on Halo has always been a popular game since I was, I guess, in high school. And I never could have imagined when I first started college that I would wind up being on a Halo game or multiple Halo games as it has been. And it's just, it's a beautiful soundtrack because of the style of the music. It involves orchestra, but it also has electronic elements, and then it has this, you know, thick, layered, ethereal choir that I sometimes layer on there, and then also solo vocals, and it's just surreal.
Well, we have a little clip right now, and we can hear a sample. Let's listen. When you go into a recording session, I mean, are there multiple takes? Is there a lot of layering? How does an actual recording session go?
I actually have a home recording studio, so I record most of my own vocals. Sometimes I do remote sessions, but my husband is also a composer, so we have a really great setup at home. And I often do multiple takes. Sometimes I provide, you know, all of the takes to the composer, and sometimes I, you know, choose the stuff first. So,
do you have any of the visuals to work with, or have they not even been?
No, I usually don't get visuals. It's usually I'm just going by verbal cues. They'll tell me, you know, what's going on in the game, and I just have to use my imagination.
Tommy, Tetris is a game that a lot of us are familiar with. We can kind of hear the music in our head.
Yeah.
And then you updated the music for Video Game Live. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, Tetris is actually, it's its 30th anniversary this year. And imagine that, 30 years ago. But the original version was... how's it pronounced, Jill? Korobeyniki?
Korobeyniki?
Yeah, something like that. and it's an old Russian folk tune, and they put that in the original game as bleeps and bloops.
Sounds like this.
So, you know, we thought it would be fun to do a Russian opera version. If we got, if you got a choir and orchestra on stage, it could maybe sound something like this.
Here you go.
There you go. See that? It's modernized.
Well, how do you approach that, Jillian? I mean, that's a very serious sounding, you know, approach that you take to it. So is it still a game in your head, or is it? How do you approach a piece like that?
It sort of transforms in my mind from a game to an opera because I am classically trained in opera, I'm practiced in singing in foreign languages, so I kind of, I translated the Russian lyrics for myself so I understood what was going on in the original folk song.
Which we don't get in Tetris, game, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah, exactly. And the lyrics there, I mean, there were lyrics to the whole, it was based around a poem, an old Russian folklore poem as well. So it's crazy. And, you know, the amazing thing about the album, too, this is all stuff you're playing off our third album, Video Games Live Level 3. You know, the first two albums, first album came out on EMI, big record label. The second album we did with PBS. It was, you know, we had a big PBS special in 2010. But the music industry, as you know, has changed so drastically, especially over the last 4 or 5 years. And so as we were trying to go around to get, you know, hey, let's do our next record deal, you know, recording a big orchestra, 100-piece orchestra, 100-person choir, you know, it's an expensive endeavor. And so no record company would take it on. So I went to Kickstarter, and we ended up being the third highest grossing album ever on Kickstarter. So the fans around the world said, we'll back it. We'll put into it. So,
well, this shouldn't surprise us that things can be wildly popular and should be taken very seriously as art, because we just heard an example of opera, which a lot of us take to be kind of a high art, but it was the people's, entertainment when it was created, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, it was only a couple hundred years ago where a bunch of loudmouth Italians like myself, all sat around a table and said, hey, let's reinvent the orchestra. I got an idea. Let's tell a story through the music and the vocals. Oh, let's create sets on stage and let's build these elaborate sets and let's dress people up in costume. And that's how opera was created, right? And so all I'm doing is I'm taking all of the things that my generation and younger grew up on, video screens and rock and roll lighting and lasers and, you know, interactivity. And so we've kind of maybe created a little bit of we're sometimes referred to as the opera of the 21st century, where we're taking symphony and modernizing it.
And speak to the folk as well. It's terrific stuff. And I want to thank you both for being on the program. Tommy Tallarico, video game composer and creator of Video Games Live, thank you for being on the program.
I appreciate it.
Jillian Aversa is a singer and a songwriter, and she performs live tonight at Video Game Live. Jill, good to talk with you as well.
Thank you very much.
North Carolina Symphony, May Mandy Hall tonight, 7:30 in Raleigh. You can hear the whole thing, see the show, and entertain your ears as well. And thank you for joining us on The State of Things. You can see more information and find links to anything we've talked about at stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao with Will Michaels. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. We go out now with another song from Video Games Live third album. This one is from the game Dota 2.